So August 16th, and it'll be 2 p.m. if you get you can get NASA through the computer. Some people have it streaming on TV. I have that now. They're going to talk about the EVA that's going to be done the following week. The EVA is going to involve connecting the ITER up. The ITER is the International Docking Adapter that was flown up there about a week or so ago from SpaceX. SpaceX brought it up in their trunk. You know, SpaceX has the vehicle itself, the Dragon, and they berthed with the International Space Station. They opened up this big 53-inch wide door, and you know, they were able to bring everything in. But that's in the pressurized area. You know, it's food, spacesuits, whatever they're bringing up. In the back of the vehicle, they always have room. It's called a trunk, and they'll bring up satellites and things that don't have to be pressurized, so it's exposed to the vacuum. And the doctor, NASA will do is the operators on at Mission Control in Houston will use the Canadian robotic arm to disconnect the ITER from SpaceX, and you're going to have two people doing a spacewalk. You're going to have Drew Morgan and Nick Haig, two Americans, that will be trying to connect ITER. Now, you need ITER for the main reason of docking crewed vehicles. Very shortly, we're going to be sending up our own crew vehicles from American soil. You're going to be sending it up on the Crew Dragon, and you're going to be sending it up on the Boeing Starliner, and eventually Dream Chaser will be able to connect to the port as well. And in the future, if anybody develops a manned flight capable vehicle, it will have the International Docking Adapter mate to connect to this thing, so you can get into the International Space Station with people. So they're going to have this news conference, and they're going to show the EVA. Now, they've done this before. They need two ITERs attached to the space station. A couple of years ago, they did one. It was successfully attached by an EVA. And then they needed the second one. It's been a long time coming. This should have been done probably a couple of years ago. When they set up ITER number one in a SpaceX vehicle about 3 or 4 years ago now. I remember it was in September. That vehicle blew up. It got near, high Q area, and it just blew up. The helium tank inside ruptured and exploded the oxygen tank, and that was the end of that mission. Well, that killed the first ITER that was supposed to be attached. So Boeing was building this thing. They were building the second one anyway, so number two finally got sent up there. And now, eventually, all these years later, they had spare parts and made some new parts, and they made ITER 3. And it's a pretty big thing. It probably weighs about 3,000 pounds. You know, a little less than that. And they have to attach it to the pressure mating adapter. Pressure mating adapter is when you used to see the shuttle attached to a space station, they were attached to a pressure mating adapter. This offset looking thing was set offset by about 22 degrees. We go in, and it was kind of like on an angle if you were flying, bringing your body through it, going from one to the other. But that was their adapter to get to into the space station. But now, that things have changed. The shuttle adapter system is out. We have the International Docking Adapter, and that's what this is about. Well, the EVA is that's going to occur the following week. It will be shown at this news conference, and they do a good job at the news conference. They have a great animation, and they show exactly what move both astronauts will be making at any given time. The astronaut lights up, cables light up that moving around, or the ITER itself. They'll show where it is now, attached to the robotic arm. They'll show it in the final position. So if you like that type of thing, if you like the way construction is, and you know, how they go about actually installing something, it would be pretty good. So that's a Friday on the NASA channel, and they usually show repeats as the days go on of the same thing if you miss it. So the actual EVA will be the following week on the 16th, 6:30 in the morning on a Wednesday. And that'll probably take many hours, usually about 6-7 hours to do something like this. You know, I have to completely bulb up the attach the ITER, and I'll have to run all the data cables and power cables and that type of thing. And they show you all the different lines and cables that they have to hook up. So so much for that. And then one other flight that's coming up, and that'll be going up August 21st, which, you know, I got another week. I can talk about it next week, but it's going to be a different Soyuz type of vehicle going up to the space station. Russians launched the Soyuz rocket, and the Soyuz spacecraft is on top. They've been doing this for decades now, and, you know, they sent our crew up with the Soyuz vehicle. They've upgraded the Soyuz vehicle. There's all kinds of new stuff on it, that they, you know, digital things that they didn't have, and they want to be able to show to themselves and to NASA that they could send this new vehicle up, dock autonomously with the space station, and then undock and come back and land with parachutes in Kazakhstan, in the steppes of Kazakhstan. So it'll be just like a regular flight. The only difference is it's not going to have a crew. Once they prove that out, future missions will be going up with the new Soyuz vehicle. Let me drop it. This is WS2M. Any questions so far on EVA, the Soyuz vehicle? Okay. Now, in space, it's a very busy place. I mean, over the last couple of weeks, they've had like 4 or 5 vehicles coming and going. And another one that's going to be going next week will be the Cygnus spacecraft. It's the 11th mission that NASA has paid for to have attached to the space station. Cygnus goes up. It's a cargo vehicle. It's launched on an Antares rocket. Nowadays, it's launched by Northrop Grumman. Used to be by Orbital ATK, and then before that, Orbital Science. But, you know, as time goes on, these companies gobble them up, you know, and eventually it all becomes Northrop Grumman. So they're the ones controlling everything. They launch out of Wallops Island in Virginia, and they launch on the Antares rocket with the RD-181, still using Russian engines. But a very successful engine. They used two of them to get to the space station and have the Cygnus dock. The Cygnus that's up there now, that's going to undock, was launched in April, so it's been up there a couple of months. And again, you know, they open up the door and they take everything out and, that they need, and eventually pile it up with garbage, because unlike the Dragon vehicle, that comes back and lands with parachutes in the Pacific Ocean. This one, burns up in the Pacific Ocean, in the above the Pacific Ocean in the atmosphere. And it, you know, that's how they get rid of all the stuff that they don't longer need in the from the ISS. They use that vehicle, and they'll use the Japanese vehicle that also burns up, and the Progress vehicle. The only one that comes back with stuff right now is the Dragon crew vehicle. But Orbital ATK has been using the Cygnus vehicle, you know, after it docks and separates from the space station. They've been using it to deploy satellites. A lot of them are CubeSats, and small satellites that are attached to the outside of the space station. And they have a launching, deploying gizmo now that they have, that the satellites will actually come up with this gizmo and it'll be located inside the Cygnus spacecraft. After it connects to the space station and the astronauts open it up and take all their stuff out, EVA suits and, you know, food and clothes, they'll remove this whole satellite, you know, the satellites and this gizmo, this deployer. When it's time to have the Cygnus leave, they fill it up all the junk and things that are going to burn up over the South Pacific. The door gets closed, and then he attaches this launching CubeSat gizmo to the outside of the spacecraft. You know, from the inside, you know, they attach it to the door. So then, now it eventually separates, goes out into space. And, you know, normally it would be getting ready to come back to Earth. But what it does now, it actually stays up there for weeks on end. And then it launches these satellites that have been sent up, that have been sitting for months sometimes, waiting to be deployed, because they'll be attached to the space station, and then Cygnus will eventually get rid of them. Northrop Grumman, who owns the Cygnus and the Antares, they want to show to NASA now that Cygnus will be a great habitat module in the future for their Gateway project. The Gateway project is the space station that they're eventually going to be putting into halo orbit around the moon. So, to show NASA how great this thing is, what they're going to do is disconnect in a week or two from the space station and deploy their satellites, you know, the CubeSats of what they're going to do. And then they're going to fly it for like 5 months. It's not going to come back. They're going to show, look at the longevity of this thing. In fact, they're going to show that they could operate two Cygnus spacecrafts at a time. There's going to be another one that's eventually going to be launched in mission control for the Cygnus spacecraft will be controlling two of them at the same time, the one that's up there now and the one that's going up to eventually dock. So they'd like to do that and leave it up for 5 months and show NASA, look, you know, this is a great thing, and we'll be able to use this as one of your living quarters permanently for a space station around the moon. Done a couple of Cygnus spacecrafts to orbit the moon. One of the interesting satellites that they have, after about a month or so after it's disconnected from the space station, still flying around in Earth orbit, it's going to raise itself. It's got its own thrusters and everything. It's going to raise itself to a higher orbit to release satellites. One of the satellites it's going to release is called the Seeker satellite. This one I like is because it's got a nice high-definition camera on it. And what it's going to do is it's going to position itself to look at the Cygnus spacecraft. And it's going to go above it, behind it, all over. Taking pictures of the Cygnus as it's in orbit, you know, space, which I really think is cool. But, and of course, there's a practical purpose for this. In the future, you know, you might want to inspect your vehicle that you're in. You know, you could have a crew on a Dream Chaser or a Starliner ship, and you might need to inspect your vehicle. Maybe somebody thinks that maybe you got, you know, a loose something or other out there. You know, let's check the antenna. Well, you'll be able to take the Seeker satellite, release it from the spacecraft, and have it go out and inspect your spacecraft without using robotic arms, without using an EVA by anybody. You'd be able to put it into a little airlock, push it out, and it could send signals back. In this case, what the Seeker is going to do is it's going to take pictures, it's going to send it back to another satellite inside the Cygnus, and from there we'll download all those pictures down to mission control, and you'd be able to do the same thing on a regular mission. So, you know, just like years ago when they had problems with the tiles on the space shuttle, Columbia, for instance, had the hole in the leading edge of its wing and the carbon. They didn't know that. But if they had this system, they might have, you know, done this on a regular basis, flown a Seeker outside, look around the spacecraft, But no, what they did is they had a 50-foot robotic arm for future missions now, you know, after the Columbia disaster. And, you know, Columbia burnt up. What they decided to do was take this 50-foot robotic arm that they have and add another 50-foot robotic arm to it. And now this long contraption would stick out from the cargo bay of the space shuttle, and it would inspect all the wings, and it would go around and look real close up to, you know, high resolution, and it got the job done. But, you know, to do that with a seeker is going to save, you know, not only money, of course, but it's going to save time and be very advantageous for future crewed missions, you know, going anywhere, in Earth orbit, to the moon, to Mars. So anyway, that's the story with the Cygnus spacecraft. You know, I mean, the capabilities have really increased. In the beginning, it used to bring up like 4,000 pounds of stuff. They've had, you know, they've improved on the Cygnus vehicle, and now, you know, they call it the enhanced Cygnus vehicle. It has different solar arrays. It used to have these big rectangular solar arrays. Now it's got these big round solar arrays built by a German company. It gives about the same amount of wattage, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 watts of power, kilowatt hours. No problem with that, but it's way lighter. And the whole system is like 600-700 pounds lighter than the other solar array system. So things like that enable them to increase their payloads. And so that's a wonderful thing. Any comments or questions for what we've covered so far? This is WS2S. Very good. Another topic, European Space Agency has pretty much completed their service module for NASA. Service module is going to be used for the Orion spacecraft. Orion is being built for the last, I don't know, 12, 13, 14 years now, I guess. Still, you know, it's come a long way, but now they're to the point where they're about ready to connect the first flight of Orion to the European Service Module. European Space Service Module, it looks like it's about twice as big as the crew part of the vehicle, which is the Orion. And it contains all the life support, it has all the fuel, it has the rockets, it's got the main rocket for, like, for instance, when they come back from the moon, they're going to need to ignite a rocket. They have this orbital maneuvering system engine that really comes from the shuttle days and, you know, puts out, you know, 8,000 pounds of thrust and connected to the back of the European Space Agency service module, which all connects to the back of the Orion spacecraft. It's got these massive solar panels coming out of it, out of the service module, probably about 60 feet long. That's like four of them, and they're going to be putting out like, I don't know, the amount of power is like 12,000 kilowatts. You know, I have a generator that I could do my house, 4,000, and this thing's going to be able to put out like three times that amount in Earth orbit. You know, you get out of the sun, you get out away from the sun to Mars, of course, that number's going to drop down seriously, but still going to be able to put out plenty of power. And they ran their test on their motor today, this week. NASA hooked it up, and they ran the motor for, 8-10 minutes or something like that. It's a restartable motor. It also gimbals in all directions. And apparently that's now a very successful piece of equipment we got from the European Space Agency. You know, NASA needed to split the cost. You know, we're building the space launch system, which includes the massive rocket bigger than the Saturn V setup, and we're building the Orion. And, you know, in the old Apollo days, we also built the service module that was attached to the Apollo, and now this is been contracted out to European Space Agency, and NASA knows it's going to work pretty good because their service module is derived from the ATV. The ATV is this massive cargo vehicle that you supplied to the International Space Station. It's the dock to the Russian side, autonomously. You just launched from French Guiana in Kourou. European Space Agency launched it on an Ariane 5 rocket, and it used to go up to the space station and dock all by itself. It was definitely the biggest cargo vehicle going. It was probably about 12,000-13,000 pounds of stuff every time it went up. Plus it had plenty of fuel, and they used to, you know, use it to raise the height of the International Space Station on a regular basis. And over the years, they flew five of these things to the space station, five autonomous transfer vehicles, ATVs, and NASA liked it so much that, you know, that would be a good idea for the service module. So they just, you know, changed a lot of things in it, put in life support systems for people, and developed this over the years. And now it's in Florida. And now, you know, the first flight is going to be unmanned. It's an unmanned flight to the moon, but, you know, it's going to do everything as if there were people in it. And then probably a year later, they'll do the actual first mission flight, which will be the same thing, go to the moon, but not land on the moon, and eventually come back. So that's the story on that. SpaceX, full quiet now. They launched a couple of missions within last week, but they're a little quiet now. I think the next launch is probably a week or two away for them, and I think they're pretty much concentrating a lot on their future manned missions, trying to get that on the, you know, squared away. They're an expert in reusability. The prices have dropped down tremendously. They've saved over 40 of their boosters over the last couple of years, returning them either to the autonomous ships or bringing them back to land on both the California side and Vandenberg. They brought them back to land as well. So they're saving a lot of money by reusing their boosters. And everybody wants to jump on the reusable booster syndrome. Boeing is talking about it eventually with the Atlas V rocket. The Boeing and Lockheed build the Atlas V. They're thinking about eventually trying to save the engines there, not the booster itself. There's another company called Rocket Lab. I've talked about Rocket Lab before. They launch out of New Zealand, North Island of New Zealand, and they use a rocket called the Electron rocket. Not that it's got electrons flowing through it, but it's got the turbopumps are used in every rocket engine, and those turbopumps have to be driven by something, and most of the times it's the gas, or, you know, from they have ignition systems where it spins up the turbos. Well, Rocket Lab doesn't do that. They just use regular electric motors, these big 50 horsepower motors hooked up to their rockets. The base has like 9 rockets, so they got 9 separate motors hooked up to the 9 separate turbos. And they need batteries, so they use the lithium ion batteries to power it. But what they've been doing now on every one of their flights, I think they're up to like flight number 7 now. You know, they've been dumping it into the ocean. You know, the booster comes down, and that's the end of their motors, their batteries, the rockets are gone. Now he's got the bright idea to start reusing these things. And his idea is, I want to reuse these boosters, but not because I'm going to save money, but because I'll be able to double my output. He has a lot of flights on his manifest. When I say he, by the way, his name is Peter Beck. He's the one that owns this Rocket Lab company launching these Electron rockets, big black Electron rockets. And he launches, puts like maybe 400 or 500 pounds of payload into orbit when he launches. He'll launch a bunch of CubeSats. He's launched some things for NASA. He launched something for DARPA once. But he's got all these things on the list, and he's trying to increase the cadence of his launches. In fact, he's opening up a launch complex in, right here in Virginia, in the States. So he'll be able to launch from there as well. The first Electron rocket should launch maybe the end of this year, the earliest, maybe beginning of next year. Right now he's got the launch complex under construction, going full blast in Virginia, completely independent from all the other sources that are down there. In Virginia, that's where they launched the Antares rocket with Cygnus, and Minotaur rockets. They launch all the sounding rockets. Well, now they're going to be launching Electron rockets from there as well. But he wants to reuse these things. He doesn't have enough fuel to bring them back to where they launched from. So his plan is have the booster come back through the atmosphere, which is the hard part. He's going from like 9G down to like nothing. But he says if he could do that, accomplish that, eventually he's going to put a parachute on the booster itself. Once these parachutes are coming down through the atmosphere, he plans on having a big helicopter go out and snag these things from before they hit the ocean, and then bring them back to dry land. So it should be an interesting sight. There's been other plans like that. Elon Musk even thought about that early on, but he decided to go with propulsion all the way down to back to the surface. This guy Peter Beck with Rocket Lab plans on using parachutes and helicopters to bring his rockets back. So I thought that was pretty interesting. Let me drop it. Any comments or questions? Okay. One other thing I wanted to bring up is something I was talking to Dr. Roy about. This amateur rocket enthusiast. His name is Mike Hughes, he calls himself Mad Mike Hughes. Mad Mike. He's one of these people. He believes in the Flat Earth, Society. Anyway, last year or so, he built a steam rocket for himself. He launched himself like 1,800 feet in the air. Damn near killed himself. He came back and with all kinds of problems, neck problems. He banged himself up pretty bad. But he's a daredevil type of guy, and his idea is to eventually get higher. Someday to get to the common line. But for now, he built another steam rocket. He got a better launcher, and this was supposed to happen today. So I have. I checked before the net. Apparently, he didn't go yet. But this is happening out west, where it's like 3 hours different from here. So maybe he made it. Maybe he didn't. So Mad Mike is going to attach himself to this steam-powered rocket, build up enough steam pressure, and he thinks this time he's going to get a mile high. Like 5,000 feet high. He's going to try to at least double his distance. And the idea is, he says, I want to be able to see the curvature of the Earth because I'm a flat earther, But we'll see if he makes it. Another guy that did this many years ago, back in 1974, was Evel Knievel, except he didn't want to get to the common line. He just wanted to get over to Snake River Valley in Idaho Falls. Evel Knievel, anybody that's young, he was a daredevil. Rode motorcycles, broke every bone in his body over the years, hundreds of jumps, and he always said, I wanted to jump the Grand Canyon. Everybody thought he was going to get a souped-up motorcycle back then, take off on one side of the Grand Canyon and wind up on the South Rim or something. But the government told him, no way, Jose, you're not going to do that. So he said, well, let me look around. He found another canyon, and it looks like a mini Grand Canyon in Idaho, and Snake River Canyon. Snake River goes through Idaho, and he built this launch pad, He built a steam-powered rocket, had himself bolted into this thing, and off he went with about 5,000 PSI and, you know, steam-powered. And off he went, and he got about halfway over. Maybe a little less than that. His parachute opened up. I never figured out exactly what happened, if he hit the button accidentally or if it went off, you know, without him doing it, but the parachute went out too early, and it slowed him down real quick, and he wound up dropping into the bottom of, all the way down to Snake River, and they flew helicopters down, and eventually they found him, and he made it, but he never made that attempt again. But this guy, man, Mike, he's going to probably do the same thing, except he's probably got a more powerful steam rocket. I haven't found out how many PSI or how much water he's got in this thing to try to do what he's doing. Now, like I said, his goal is to get to the common line, 62 miles up in the air, or 100 kilometers. But to do that, of course, he's not going to be able to use a steam-powered engine. He wants to build a hydrogen peroxide engine, different countries have developed over the years. Russia had it, we had it early on for different purposes. Well, he wants to build this thing, and that itself is not going to be able to power him all the way up to where he wants to go. So he's going to take a balloon. He wants to take the balloon, attach this rocket, this hydrogen peroxide rocket to a balloon, float himself up to like 20 miles into the air. I think it's about as high as a balloon will go. And then, be sitting in this rocket that takes all these hours, whatever it takes to get up to that kind of height. And then blast himself to the common line, 100 kilometers up, and then come back. And then he's going to be very happy because I'm sure by then he'll be able to see the curvature of space. That's the story I'm mad. Mike, any questions or comments? This is WS2N for the Space Network.
Yeah, Paul, a little addendum. Apparently, he is dedicating his launch today, which may or may not have ever happened, to the president.
Is that right? Oh, my goodness. I haven't heard that one yet. But, I know he's got his fingers crossed. I hope he don't, injure himself big time. I mean, he does it on the cheap, I guess. Last time he had a trailer or something he launched from. Now somebody donated him a tractor trailer this time. And he's going to drive that out to wherever he's got to go. So, we'll see how he does. And, I'm surprised it's not on the news. He's being recorded by the Discovery Channel. And later on, I guess next year or something, they're coming out with a show that's going to highlight people that are doing this type of thing that would like to get to space somehow one way or another. So they're going to highlight Mad Mike. Okay, Roy, thanks for that. Anything else or any other comments?
Well, that's pretty much it. Apparently, Discovery has a new science channel. They're going to have a show that's called Homemade Astronauts. So maybe he's waiting for that to release his results. My guess is that we're going to find out tomorrow it was scratched because some politician said, you're not going to do that here. Because that's what happened, I think, the last time. It took a bit of time for him to get the approval to act out like this. I'd love to know how much of this is performance art and how much of this is just that he's wackadoodle crazy.
Yeah, I know. If you've been around steam, though, I spent all my life around steam boilers, and you got to be real, real careful with this stuff. I mean, like I said, Evel Knievel got up to, I think, 5,000 PSI. With 5,000 PSI in any tank system or pipe system, and you're looking for trouble, you better make sure everything holds together. Everything better be helioxed right down to, an x-ray before you even, thought this thing up.
think this guy has any of that capability? I mean, I'm sure there are people there who would do it for him, but I don't know. He kind of strikes me as the type of guy who's just rather more gung-ho than going to do X-ray analysis of weld joints.
Unfortunately for him, I think you're right, unfortunately. Well, you know, maybe he does have some people working with him. I mean, somebody donated him a truck. Just here's a big, you know, tractor trailer. So I guess if you're maybe outrageous enough, you could get people to back you. They said somebody, he was, I know what it was, a dating website was helping finance this guy. So, you know where he's coming from, right?
Yeah, he has it plastered all over the rocket. It's, I think, hudapp.com, and it says, dating isn't rocket science. So he's advertising a dating app.
Oh, does he? Okay. And it's a woman, like, it was like a part of a picture of him standing next to, you know, a pointy part of the rocket that I wasn't able to read. It was a purple-looking thing. So we'll see how he does. I wanted to say something about this. It went out of my head. But, wow. I hope he makes it, because, you know, you don't want to see anybody do something like this and kill himself. He's going to go up a mile, and he's got to hope this parachute thing works. And I hope he's got a bigger parachute than last time, because that's how he got hurt. And when he came down, it came down too fast. And I guess he's kind of lucky he survived that. And he's no kid. He's 65. I think they said he was 62 last night. So I guess he's probably 64 maybe now. Wow. Okay. Any other comments or questions on any of the topics? You know, the Cygnus spacecraft, the Space Launch System, Mad Mike, this WS Twin. Any comments?
Paul, what's the latest on status, costing, overrun, launch date of James Webb Space Telescope? It's been delayed a number of times, but have they set a fairly firm date of when it's likely to be launched, K2RIW?
Yeah, that was supposed to be up, 2017? Wow, and here it is, 2019. So it's already 2.5 years delayed. I think early 2021. So I don't even think it's going to get next year. And it's still scheduled to go up on an Ariane 5 rocket. They're doing away with the Ariane 5 rocket. I guess they'll keep one extra one around for the Space Webb telescope. Ariane 5 is supposed to be replaced by an Ariane 6. And NASA would not be crazy about this thing going up on a brand new rocket. The fairing's going to be big enough. They could do it. But, you know, the Ariane 5 is a proven rocket. It's had almost 80 flights, and they consider them all successful. It's a hydrogen, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket with a couple of solid boosters attached to it. And it's very successful. And that's why they're entrusting this. How much does it cost now? $10, $11 billion, I think, now to build this thing. Putting it in their hands. See, that's the European Space Agency's, contribution to this flight. This way they're allowed to get, entitled to get all the information and everything back from James Webb. So, that's the deal. We decided not to launch it ourselves and let them, pay for it. So that's how that started. But that should have been up there already. Back to you, Dick.
Are you saying Ariane has never had a failure?
Yeah, it's kind of like Atlas V. They get Atlas V and another one with 100%. Ariane 5 is... had problems with the second stage on some of the satellites that were going to orbit, but because they have the satellites themselves have rockets on them and sometimes electric propulsion, all their satellites were able to get to their in assigned location, either polar or geosynchronous flights, as far as I know, Dick.
Sounds good. So right now, I think you said 10-20, by 2020 or 2021 is the proposed launch date of James Webb.
Yeah, I'll have to check. Time's getting away from me. Thought it was going to be September. Last time I heard it was September of next year. But then they were talking about future delays, so that's what's making me think of our early 21. But we got a ways to go for that. Next year's big flight that I'm looking forward to is the Mars 2020 rover. And that's going up next, I guess, next summer. So that's going to be great. And that'll take probably 6 to 8 months to get to Mars. I think that's the two big flights that are coming up. There's a lot of constant flights that are going here. Every week there's something going up. But they're the big science ones. Back to you.
I've got a puzzle for Roy and Paul. The Earth and Moon, 240,000 miles distance between them, have a certain gravity force between them. So the Earth pulls on the Moon, its gravity, forces the Moon to be in a circle, a path around the Earth. And by comparison, the Moon pulls on the Earth and creates the tides. The amount of gravity you get is proportional to mass. The Earth has roughly 100 times more mass than the Moon. So the bigger object, the Earth, pulls on the Moon with a certain amount of force. The Moon's 100 times lower in mass, and it pulls on the Earth with a certain force. What do you believe is the ratio of the force of the Earth pulling the Moon versus the force of the Moon pulling on the Earth? I'll pass it over to you first, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW.
I don't know offhand. Is it the square of the difference between the two?
Okay, that's one possible guess. Let's see what Paul's got to say. Since the Moon is 100 times lower in mass, is the Moon's force on the Earth, what ratio compared to the Earth's force on the Moon due to gravity? WS2N, K2RIW.
I was going to go with, instead of 100, because it's 101, I was going to go with probably 400, you know. Because normally I would say 200, but you got two bodies involved, you know. You know, kind of like the theory, you know, when you have a wind hitting your house, you double the wind speed and you wind up with four times the force, that type of thing. I don't know, I'm going to go with 400 to 1, Dick.
It turns out that, I can't think of his name all of a sudden, Veritasium, the YouTube videos, Derek Mueller, has this as one of his puzzles. Almost everybody gets this one wrong. The equation for the amount of force of gravity equals the gravity constant, mass 1, mass 2, divided by distance squared. The force between Earth and Moon is like a rubber band. It pulls one to the other. The two forces are identical. When you plug in the numbers for Earth and Moon to that equation, it's a gravity constant, mass of Earth, mass of Moon, divided by radius squared. They are both the exact same force. Like I said, it's like a rubber band between the two. Ain't that crazy? Over to you first, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Indeed. Well, yeah, I mean, there's so many kind of things to kind of keep in mind with the Earth and the Moon that despite that it's balanced, it's probably not, in some way, not perfectly balanced because the Moon is perpetually taking a little bit of kinetic energy from the Earth, and it's spinning a little bit faster and a little bit further away from us.
Yeah, the Moon gains in altitude 1.5 inches per year. which is pretty slow, but when you integrate that over a million or a billion years, it does build up into something significant. A billion years ago, the moon was a hell of a lot closer, and the Earth was a lot faster than 24 hours, probably a 12-hour day instead of a 24-hour day. So the kinetic energy of the Earth's rotation by way of the tides and the friction of the tide is slowly being coupled into the moon, and the moon is moving out inch and a half per year. So let's see what Paul's got to say about this. Ain't that crazy? The force between the two is identical. By the way, the gravity center, more moon and Earth are really a binary system. And I think the mass center is something like 1,000 miles below the equator of the Earth. So the Earth is wobbling about that point, and the moon is rotating about that point. The gravity center, roughly 1,000 miles below the equator. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, yeah, that type of thing will keep you up. That'll keep me up thinking about it. Very good. Yeah, so you're saying basically no matter what the force is, even if you replace the Earth with Jupiter, you're saying that the force is equal because they're pulling against each other. That same rubber band would be put around the two objects. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I am. In the case of Jupiter, it would be a bigger force, but the force on each would be identical. If you actually carefully plotted the Earth's path around the Sun, you think it's a nice elliptical path, almost a circle. In reality, it's got 12 wiggles to it because of what the moon is doing. The moon goes around the Earth about 12 times in a year. So the Earth doesn't have a nice smooth path. It's got these periodic wiggles. WS2N, K2RIW.
Very good, Dick. And I'm looking at the time. A couple of minutes left. I wanted to talk about the Perseid meteor showers. That happened actually Monday night, tomorrow night late, preferably the later the better, after 12 o'clock at night it would be even better, but you'd be able to see a couple of things probably 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. The moon will be out, and I believe later in the day on Tuesday it's going to get cloudier and probably rain during the day on Tuesday, so maybe there'll be intermittent clouds on Monday night. Probably not, though. You might be able to see something. So if anybody's off or for some reason you're up in the middle of the night at 12, 1, especially like 2, 3 in the morning, the Perseid meteor showers would be out. You could look anywhere. You don't have to really look for that constellation. It's anywhere in general. You'd be able to see these things. There's a lot less during the during the Perseid meteor shower than, let's say, the Gemini meteor shower. But Gemini is in the middle of the winter, and nobody wants to stand out there with 30-degree temperatures. But this is summertime, so it's pretty good. Some people might still be off with school and everything and get a chance to see these things. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
WS2N, GXM.
GXM, go ahead.
Should be a lot better weather tonight and tomorrow morning. This will be able to get some of the Perseids in after 3 a.m. this morning, and the moon will be setting earlier, WB2GXM.
Yeah, that's true, but the main one is for, they said, Monday night. It's an early Monday morning. It's an early Tuesday morning.
Is this supposed to be a good Perseid year, Paul, or just a medium one, do you know?
I read good, but, I've seen it before, and it's pretty cool, but, one every, couple of minutes, on Long Island. If we were in a darker area, I'm sure it would be better.
Of all the meteor showers you've ever seen, Paul, you ever seen a great big bolide where during the couple of minutes it's flashing, you could read a book, so to speak? Have you ever seen one of those? I haven't.
No, I've read about it. That would be something to remember.
That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Okay, I guess we're over. 73, you all. See you next week. Bye-bye for now. K2RIW.
Thanks for doing the net, Dick. 73, have a good night, Roy, and everybody else listening. WS2N clear. Roy?
You call. Thank you, Dick. Thanks to everyone who participated once again, and just to remind everyone, if you have any mailbag questions for Dick, or if you have any topics you'd like me to cover, or if you have any puzzles you'd like to share, it's mailbag@ac2gs.com. And in order to read any of the articles that were the basis of these little stories that I told tonight, it's on a web page. Put your browser at roy.ac2gs.com. So have a great week, everyone, and this is AC2GS clear.
PD2SHN with a question.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5:00 a.m. This is the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Contacted and couldn't, but later on, once we got up there,
solid contact being so yeah, it's like 40 miles compared to Hagerstown. Man, it was like we're talking town, clear spell. And then that guy out the other sub still wasn't sure where he was because it's so clear. So I got home last night. vertical antenna. So, I mean, it works, but because I've got to use the ground radio, it's just too many logs and stuff. So it wasn't really late.